Fall camp is in swing for the Oregon Duck football program. Over a week in to camp, and we've learned some pretty significant things around this Oregon football program. What those are, let us tell you. Welcome into the Autzen Audibles podcast. I'm Matt Prehm, Eric Scopel on the show as always. And as we said, the Oregon Duck football program is now over a week in to its fall camp practice schedule. We've had opportunities to talk with a lot of, at least half the coaches, head coach Dan Lanning a couple times. We've had Oregon Media Day, and there's been some things around this program. Some answers have already been answered, and or some questions have already been answered, Eric. And then we've also got now some new questions that have come up because of what we've learned during fall camp. We're going to dive into just kind of like four early storylines that we know about with this Oregon football program and kind of where things go. I guess Eric, I'll lead us off.
Sure. And
for me, I'm going to that second year player group. Some of these guys are going to be redshirt freshmen. Some of these guys are true sophomores that played a lot of football last season. But could this year's second year group, sophomores, redshirt freshmen, become the backbone of this roster? I think it's one of the most underappreciated storylines of the season. Who takes the biggest jump in their second year in the system? Who goes from a really good young player to one of the best players in college football at their position, an NFL-type player? Could Oregon's sophomore class actually be the difference in the 2025 team being into the playoff, getting a couple wins, and then losing to Indiana, to now them growing into the 2026 team and being a true national champion caliber team? Reason I bring this up, I mean, think about the sophomores this year that we know Oregon is going to be starting and going to be leaning heavily on. Brandon Finney at corner. You've got DeCorian Stewart at receiver. You've also got De'Aaron Hill. You've got Jordan Davidson at running back. I guess they're not second-year players, but they're redshirt sophomores. You've also got Ife Obadegwu and Aaron Flowers, who are going to be starters in the secondary as well as redshirt sophomores. You've got another redshirt sophomore in Fox Crater, who's going to be starting along the offensive line for the Ducks at tackle. And then we go down the list, and there's a guy like Matt Johnson, who is redshirted last year as a true freshman, is a redshirt freshman this year, and is in a position where he might play a lot of football. He won't start because obviously Amari Washington, Barry Alexander are back, but you get the sense this is like the next Amari Washington, the guy that's played a little bit as a freshman, goes into his sophomore year, doesn't start, but plays a ton, super productive, and you go, well, yeah, he just needs reps. He's going to get to the NFL. I kind of think this sophomore class or this redshirt freshman class, this could be the group that kind of dictates how good Oregon's going to be. Obviously, Oregon's got studs that are upperclassmen, seniors, juniors. You know, Dante Moore is going to be a junior. Your entire front four of your defensive line are all senior guys. Evan Stewart at receiver, really productive player there. I forgot Jeremiah McClellan, a redshirt sophomore at receiver. But those guys are all established. They were going to be great. Oregon was going to be good because they were on the roster. But what could be the difference could be the sophomore redshirt freshman class. Those two groups of guys that really elevates Oregon from being a playoff team that won a couple games to one that wins three or four in the playoffs and wins the whole thing.
Yeah, a couple more names. Like, I mean, the cool thing about this class, which was at the time the best in program history, I think it was ranked fifth in 2025. But like two other names you haven't mentioned, Matt, like that I'm really excited about, who we didn't see a ton of last year, but we kind of know about, like Nasir Wyatt taking a big leap.
Yep.
Naeem Offord, who maybe he's fresh in my mind because we just spoke with him a couple days ago, is projected to be very much again in the corner rotation, and somebody who, like, sure, it wouldn't surprise me if by, you know, at some point in this season, he's starting games or just feels like a starter because of the way he's playing. Right. So, right. You know, like you run through those names, Matt, like, you're right. Like this should be like this 2025 class. We could look back at and feel like it's one of the better classes the school has produced, like just point blank. Like, I think it's early, But like we think about, just think about the first year and the number of guys. I mean, the fact that they had a starting corner who was a freshman All-American, a starting receiver who before going down with injury would have been a freshman All-American, a couple of running backs who were, you know, very much in that same conversation, and like, you know, Davison, who thankfully is healthy, I guess I'll say. We'll kind of leave it there, it sounds like, or he's at least practicing. 15 touchdowns last year. Like, he's a guy. We already know that, right? De'Aaron Hill Jr. led the country in yards per carry average last year. He's a guy. We already know that. But these guys should get better. Like, there's already the established players, like you're kind of saying. And then there's a bunch of these younger players, like you mentioned, a Matt Johnson, and a Nasir Wyatt, and Naeem Offord. Like, are we going to be surprised if somebody from that class ends up emerging on the offensive line, right? Like, whether it be a Zaire Addison or a Douglas Utu. Like, there's just a lot of players here to talk about. And I'm happy you brought this up. Like, I think something to be really optimistic about if you're an Oregon fan. And one other name, Gavin Nix, is somebody who I'm just about to talk about when we get to one of my keys or takeaways, I guess, to this point. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if in 2026 you're like, wow, a lot of these younger players are playing. And then that sets you up in 2027 and in some cases to 2028 for this group to just continue to be, like you said, Mal, use your word, the backbone of a really, really good Oregon football team. So, no, I think that's a really good one. And you're seeing, like, you can run through this roster, and there's probably not a single position group that sophomore, redshirt, freshman class is not impactful with.
Yeah, I mean, how many guys already do we feel like will be NFL guys? Like, I'm not going to sit here and argue first round, second round, just – guys that we feel like pretty confidently, hey, they're probably going to get their name called. I mean, DeCorian's going to get it. Brandon Finney's going to get it. Ife Obadegwu is going to get it. Nasir Wyatt, I think, will get it. I think we can throw in Matt Johnson. We'll get there as well.
What about Trey McNutt, Dorian Brew, two top 100 defensive backs who we aren't bringing up here, but who probably should be brought up?
Yeah. And that's a good point. Those two guys were not on the field last season playing in the secondary for Oregon because of injury, and now they're healthy, now they're back, and from what Hampton has said, both guys are progressing and should be able to help this team play in 2026. So again, I think the second year player, the redshirt sophomore, who would technically be a third year player, these two groups of guys, these two classes might be the difference in Oregon getting to the national championship and winning it compared to last season.
I'll jump in now for my first one. And I'm moving special teams to the forefront because I think we place it behind us so much this offseason. And almost every time we've had a podcast or a story talking about things that maybe are a little bit question marky or a little bit of a concern, somebody brings up, hey, Oregon does have to replace its place kicker, its punter, and its long snapper. That's a lot to replace. How many times have we seen a season derailed because of bad special teams? Or not even necessarily bad, but like a missed field goal here. Oregon fans know all about that. An extra point that doesn't quite go the way it needs to there, and it ends up kind of sending a season down the spiral. So with that said, I think one of the things that really surprised me, I think it was pretty surprising on Monday, was they were five practices into fall camp, and Joe Lorig's already telling us, we know who the kicker is, it's Gage Hurich. We know who the punter is, it's Bailey Ettridge. He didn't say we know who the long snapper is, but I think they do know it's RJ Todd. Like, they already know who these guys are. And these are new players, two of which have had some significant playing experience. RJ Todd's a senior, I think, who's had a ton of snapping at Western Michigan. Bailey Ettridge is 28 years old. We could do the whole story there. It's wild. He was a welder for a while back in Australia, found Pro Kick Australia, a punting school there, and kind of landed on his feet here as a 28-year-old sophomore. I mean, very unique. If he plays out his whole eligibility, he'll be a 30-year-old player by the time this ends, which is just nutty to think about, but it's just the reality of it. Those two guys had some experience, and Gage Hurich, not quite as much, right? Like, that's the point. I think where you can get a little concerned. But the fact that Joe Lorig's already like, I know these are the guys. Like, there's competition ongoing, but everybody on the specialist, you know, side of this is aware, like, these are the people. It's going to be Gage place kicking. It's going to be Bailey as a punter. RJ is going to be our long snapper. I know fans will still be concerned until Gage goes out there and hits those key kicks. Sure. And Bailey shows he can directionally punt with the game on the line and put the other team at a disadvantage and pin them deep. But I think it's encouraging. I think of the things I've heard in fall camp now that feel like the most meaningful, I think just the fact that the special teams coordinator already knows where this is headed 5 days into fall camp tells me one of two things. The optimistic point of view is these guys just look the part and they've been awesome all offseason, and it's just a no-brainer because they've got, you know, people they feel really confident in. And then the pessimistic or less optimistic point of view would be, well, maybe there's just not a lot of competition. Maybe they just only brought in a good punter, a good kicker, and a good long snapper, and there might still be some issues, but the real reason these guys are emerging is because there's just not enough good talent around them. It could be that, right? I'm not familiar, really. I don't think any of the listeners are either with, like, where Rocco Graziano is or some of these punters who, frankly, when Joe Lorg was throwing their names out, there were almost new names to me because they're brand new to the roster. So it's possible that's the case. I'm choosing to lean a little optimistic here and say that Joe, who has clearly been, you know, bringing Gage along with intentionality for the last couple of years, and, you know, I ID'd Bailey as somebody who averaged 45.7, I think it is, yards per punt last year in his first time doing this role. Like, he's been playing football for 18 months, and his first year playing, he had almost a 45 yard per punt average. I'm choosing to believe that these guys are emerging, they're showing stuff in practice, and that the confidence that Joe has in kind of naming them, quote unquote, because it's not official, but basically saying these are the heavy leaders, these are going to be the guys, comes from a place of they're saying positive things in practice. And to me, that should be an exhale for Oregon fans who are worried about special teams.
Yeah, the fact that they came out and just openly admitted kind of – I mean, he threw in the caveat of, you know, he's still got to finish the job, but right now we feel very confident that these are – you know, such and such is the starter here. Such and such is the starter here. And such is the leader in here. And what was really interesting to me with Gage Heirich was the fact that they kind of felt this way last year when Atticus Sappington was still the primary kicker. And they were willing to, you know, Joe Lorig said, like, we took opportunities to just kind of sprinkle in here and there PAT opportunities for Gage to get him in there, get him in a game. And that explains, like, how many times did we cover a game at Austin Stadium last season and be like, huh, that's weird. Gage is kicking the PAT. Like, why are they doing that?
I can tell you it happened 16 times based on the stat book. So 16 times potentially.
But we were like, huh, strange. All right, whatever. I guess they're just trying to get, you know, someone else in there or whatever. See if they can do it better or whatnot. And it wasn't necessarily that they're trying to see if Gage could do it better, but it was more so like, I thought Lorig's breakdown was perfect. Of hey, everyone, when you're on special teams, everyone is watching the kicker. You know, like, the play happens, all eyes are on the kicker for the entire play, for the pretty much. Yeah. He said, you know, yeah, naturally that happens at quarterback for offense, but the ball is snapped, the quarterback makes a throw or hands the ball off, and the eyes of everyone in the stands shifts to pretty much where the ball goes. They track the ball. Now, there are people out there that are the football junkie that's like, I'm going to watch the offensive line, and that's what I'm paying attention to or whatever. But he said for special teams, though, it's different. When the kicker goes out there, it's literally eyes are on the kicker the entire time. And so they used last year's opportunities. And you said 16 PAT tries. He made all 16, right?
Yeah, he did.
As an opportunity to – get him experience in that setting where, yeah, everyone's watching you and you have to perform, because if you don't, everyone sees it. And now there's the pressure of a PAT is different than the pressure of a field goal attempt. And the pressure of a field goal attempt when you're up 36 points to, you know, kicking one when it's a tie game in the fourth quarter, those are different things. But at least having and finding ways to get Gage prepared for this is invaluable. And they saw enough where they felt like last year, this is the dude. And Eric, pardon me, wonders, like, is Rocco Graziani like the next one behind Gage, or do they wait a little bit and see, kind of, you know, spread it out a little bit from an age perspective? And, you know, maybe they find a guy in a couple of years that can replace Gage. when he ages out, because he's only going to be a redshirt sophomore, right?
Yeah.
For next season. So this is his job for 3 years.
That was exactly what I was going to go, and not to stay on Gage too long, but I think listeners here, we talk so much about other position groups, and maybe it's just worth going through a little bit of the backstory there with him. I did write an extensive story at over 1,000 words back right after spring ball. I think probably published, I could probably find the exact date, but sometime in early May, of just his story. And it's an interesting one. I mean, Gage Hurich, for listeners, is an incredible athlete. This guy was an All-American in lacrosse, being recruited by like the Syracuses, all the big East Coast schools. Like, he was like a 5-star caliber lacrosse prospect. In the middle of high school, he realized, hey, I kind of like being out close to home. And if I'm going to focus on lacrosse, I'm going to have to go all the way across the country. And he had been like he'd been playing football. He was a good football player, but he didn't think he was like a Division I caliber, like,
dude, you know,
wide receiver, defensive back. He had been handling kicking duties like since 8th grade and had been really good at it, but he'd never like really put much effort behind it. And he just one summer decided, like, I'm going to like go to one of these camps and see what happens. And he goes to a camp, and I think he finishes like 3rd or 4th place, again, with like no real training at it, and goes, huh, I'm pretty good at this, and decides to really go all in on it, and bypasses the opportunities to play lacrosse at these big schools, and instead focuses on football, and pretty much immediately becomes a standout at Westland, gets interest from Oregon, and here we are. So he is somebody that has, I think, unique background. Like, we know in the spring game, he tried a couple 50-yard kicks, didn't nail them, but the distance was good. It was just accuracy in terms of being online. I think this is going to be an interesting player just to monitor. Like, I know people don't get too excited about place kickers, but I wouldn't be surprised if we at times are like, man, this guy can absolutely smash the ball, because this is just not to take anything away from Atticus, who was admittedly like a weight room warrior and really focused on his body and everything. But like, I think Gage is maybe just a little bit different kind of an athlete than the average place kicker you see at this level. So just kind of a little bit of information on him, because it sounds like Bailey and Gage are going to be the guys. And we know a little bit about both of them, and they both have kind of unique backstories that I think are worth sharing. So just, I think, good to get that out there, and we'll see what this looks like come fall. I think you're exactly right, Matt. Like, it's very different to hit 16 PATs in games the Ducks are up by multiple scores than it is to go out there like Atticus did in the rain and in the cold in Iowa and drill a kick to win a football game. We'll see how Gage handles those moments, but I love the fact that Joe's already taken off a little bit of the pressure by saying, hey, here's a little bit of field time with 60,000, with 80,000 people watching, just to go make sure you can do it with that kind of pressure. We'll see what it looks like when it ramps up. But I think there's reason to be confident in these young guys. And shoot, we'll have things to talk about if there aren't.
Yeah. All right, I'll go to my next one. Evan Stewart's comeback could dramatically change Oregon's offensive ceiling. The more we've heard Stewart speak, the more this feels like one of the best individual stories on the team. Because remember, a year ago, he couldn't really walk normally. Now he says he's more explosive, feels like he's in the best shape of his life, describes himself as essentially having been starved of football and is extra motivated to do what's necessary for whatever the team needs. And there's another part of his development that I think is kind of starting to emerge that we haven't talked a lot about while he was being injured, was becoming a leader. DeCorian Moore has specifically pointed towards maturity, treatment habits, and willingness to help younger receivers. Dante Moore has highlighted just the growth that he has made on and off the field in this past year of kind of being away from the football program. And it comes to a point now, Eric, where I wonder, like, do we need to think of Stewart as Oregon's wide receiver one?
Mm.
Because what happens if he doesn't get hurt last season, has the big year? Do we look at Dak in the manner that we do today, or are we looking at Stewart as Dak, or are we looking at them both in the similar light? I don't know what that answer is. Or is Stewart's greatest value to this team in 2026 now going to be opponents have to account for him alongside Dak, alongside Jeremiah McClellan, alongside Ivers and Hooks and everyone else? And what does a healthy Stewart actually add that Oregon didn't have last season. I think his top end speed is going to be absolutely dynamic.
Yep.
I don't know if they had that last season. I think, you know, obviously Dak's pretty fast, but I would consider Dak being like an explosive quick guy that if you let him get away, then he will run away from you. I think Evan Stewart, I think the story is one of the better stories from an individual standpoint of his building himself back to being an elite receiver. And then two, the impact that he will have on the football field, and how does he become wide receiver one, or is he more of almost like a decoy or a guy that's out on the field that you have to account for that allows more opportunities for a Dak to go one-on-one and win those battles?
I mean, there are multiple points to the story, and I'm happy you touched on all of them. I think the personal journey of, like, I just go back and think, we've interviewed him at two different media days because he wasn't available in 2025 because of the injury. And in 2024, Matt, my big takeaway was, this guy was talking a lot about Texas A&M. He was kind of focused on the pass and personal slights, and, you know, you can go back and watch that. He spent a lot of time talking about the quarterback play wasn't great at A&M, and things are better at Oregon, and that's a those are perfectly fine things to say at a new place, but you kind of wondered, and you heard things a little bit about, like, where is his focus at? So now in 2026, he just feels like a different guy, and he seems so dialed in. Everyone we've heard talk about him raves about where he's at from a mental perspective, how much he's helping younger players, taking people under his wings, just being that veteran player that frankly, like, as you know, Matt's first key is about how many of these young players are contributing. They need role models like this. They need people around them to be, you know, players of his caliber who are also good people who can kind of share what they've learned. It's a huge value to this team. And I think the maturity he's shown and grown up over the last, you know, year and a half plus is significant. And that's important. And then to your point, Matt, like, what does it mean on the field? You know, I think you asked, like, you begged the question of, like, if he was healthy last year, what does that do for this year's wide receiver room? I think it pretty clearly means Evan Stewart's not here, because I think he's off in the NFL. If he'd had a solid season to a great season, he would have taken his name and entered the NFL draft. I know that was his plan going in. Obviously, it didn't go to plan. I think at this point, though, like, I'm kind of leaning towards, like, maybe he's going to be wide receiver one. But does wide receiver one necessarily feel like somebody who's reaching 1,000 yards or breaking school records or being in those conversations? And I say that because I think that's the great thing about this receiving room, is that if everyone's healthy, knocking on wood, they have so many different options, so many different paths to go, so many different people that have different skill sets, I think, complement each other, that, like, I could see this being a case where on a game-by-game basis, like, hey, Evan had his game this week. Oh, now it's Dak's week. Oh, here's Jeremiah with two or three big weeks in a row. And don't forget, Jamari out here carving defenses up. If Iverson Hooks gets his opportunity, we've heard, you know, whether it be Rashad Samples or Drew Maringer talk about De'Aaron Hill and kind of his versatility. I just think there's a lot to be really excited about at receiver right now, and Evan is central to it. And I think the fact that he can be both that leader in the locker room, but also that player that on the field on a Saturday can totally change the game, I think his value probably almost gets overlooked a little bit. And if you're looking at this offense, like, he's unique in that regard, right? Like, he's the oldest skill player of this group, and there's a chance he's most talented or one of the most talented too, right? And that's kind of a unique situation on an offense where you look around and you go, like, a lot of sophomores here, a lot of redshirt freshmen, a lot of younger players. Here's this older guy who's entering year, I believe, five of college football. And he's going to be a leader here, both because of the way he plays, but also because of the way he acts in the locker room. So I'm happy you had identified him, because I think I agree. I think this is a big year for him, and his inclusion in this offense is really significant for everybody involved. All right, I'm going to jump now into my second and final takeaway from this one. And this is, I would say, a little bit less positive and more just, Matt kind of alluded to it earlier, we got answers to some questions. We also now have more questions. And this one is because of Braden Platt, who Dan Lanning on Tuesday told us is dealing with an injury, kind of undisclosed. It was something he found in spring, and they're not sure. There's no timetable for when he'll return, and he left it pretty up in the air, right? And that's not a player we think is going to start. I think everybody is kind of the belief that it'll be Jerry Mixon and Devin Jackson. And there's been certainly a lot of Devin Jackson praise, which I think can kind of be used here as a positive. We can talk about some of that and how maybe that changes some of this discussion. But when we talked about this linebacker rotation, it was always you've got those two seniors and then you've got a couple of younger players in Agavin Nix, who just finished up his first year, and then in Braden Platt and Dylan Williams, who are entering year three but have been kind of either banged up or not in the rotation, kind of unclear what these guys are going to be, but there's a lot of enthusiasm for the upside. And now you take one of those three younger guys out. And to me, that's interesting. That's a little bit of a concern because, as we know, at Oregon, you're going to see two starters play a lot, but you're going to see one or two other guys off the bench come in and play 15 snaps per game, 20 snaps here or there. Maybe they get a certain matchup and you see them play 25 or 30 snaps. Or if somebody goes down again, knock on wood, they're going to have to carry the load. And you just took out one of those names. You just removed Braden Platt from the discussion, at least for the time being. And we'll see what a return looks like. Dan, again, didn't really give us any indication of when that might be. I think that's not insignificant, especially for a group that I think we can be honest about is in the conversation for the biggest question marks from a position group on this roster, right? It's like linebacker on defense, it's offensive line on offense. What does this do for linebacker? Well, it doesn't make you feel any better. So it's not like a raise the alarm. This is a disaster. It's a five alarm fire type of situation by any means, but it is I already had some concerns and question marks about this group. You take away one of the guys who I was feeling good about being a contributor, and now I don't feel quite as good.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. This is a unit where they've doubled down on, they're not going after the transfer portal. They're banking on their internal development. And that is a completely fair and understandable take to go down, especially sure. when you've recruited this position and your player development the last couple of years has been what it is. I mean, Brian Michalowski has produced NFL linebackers every year for a couple of years now, for three years in a row. And the track record suggests he is an elite developer at the linebacker position. He's getting guys to the next level. That matters. And from a recruiting perspective, they continue to bring in big name after big name. And so they've kind of collectively agreed, like, we like our dudes. We like our development. We like the progress. We like the projections that we're seeing. We're banking on these guys. Now, unfortunately, one of those guys isn't going to be available to play in Braden Platt for the foreseeable future, at least.
Yeah.
And that was a guy that when you look at your roster, you said, okay, if you looked at the top four, these were all going to be guys that were going to be entering their third year, fourth year, and in Devin Jackson's case, fifth year in the program. Now, all of a sudden, one of your top four guys is could be a Agavin Nix, who is in his second year in the system. But now, you know, Braylon Hodge is a true freshman. Tristan Phillips is a true freshman. Where does Will Stratton, who's a fourth-year player. He played in 14 games last year, but he's a walk-on. You know, like, he wasn't a guy that was going to be a scholarship player. And look, Dan Lanning's always said, if you're good enough, you're old enough. Age doesn't matter. But you're at a position where your top four guys were all experienced in the system, multi-year experience. Now one guy is out, and you're going to have to call on some younger guys, and you're just really banking on the fact that they're going to be old enough because they're ready.
Yeah, right. So let's talk out a best case real quick, Matt, and then we can wrap this one. But let's say Jerry Mixon and Devin Jackson are just straight up dudes. They both take the step, and you feel really good about those two. I mean, Devin's name is brought up all over the place. I mean, there's probably not, aside from Evan Stewart, like a hotter name on this roster right now. Like it's regionally, it's nationally because of the freaks list where he was, I think, the 11th player. And they talked about 25 or 24 miles per hour, you know, speed training results, which is just everybody. I mean, Dan actually downplayed, like, I think 24 sounds awfully high. I don't even know if that, like, I think that might not be quite accurate because it was such a lofty number. But regardless, like, as Dan said, maybe the fastest linebacker in the country. It really, best case is he puts it all together, Jerry puts it all together, and then you just need one of the Gavin, Dylan, and like you brought up, the two true freshmen, maybe one of those guys emerges and is a little bit quicker to being ready and to contribute at this level. than we expect, it really might just take one more guy. And that's the best case here, and that you lose Braden and you go, man, he could have been that guy. But between Gavin and Dylan and Tristan and Braylon, there's enough there that one of those four is ready to be that fill-in who plays that 15 to 20 snaps per game, you know, from a week-to-week basis. So that's the best case. I think the worst case is you get to a situation here where you go, man, and I don't necessarily know if I believe this because the hype has been so strong with Devin, but man, it's just another year with Devin Jackson where we're the same. We all know he's got incredible – I mean, how many times have we talked about the 10, 500-meter speed and how athletic he is? And he just isn't putting it together. And they really need one of these younger guys to come in and take over this job because we just don't think Devin Jackson can be, you know, a good enough player to really push this thing over the finish line. And boy, it would have been great if we had Braden Platt because Dylan's not working out and Gavin's kind of up and down. And you end up with a situation where you get to, you know, the midpoint of the season, you go, man, it really hurts not having this Braden, you know, Braden Platt would have been somebody that would have been a big contributor and would have changed this thing. Right. So like Eileen is probably more going to be the first option, door number one, I guess, rather than door number two, which is awfully pessimistic. But I think it's possible both cases could play out, right? Where it's like a lot of this, again, and I hate to boil the whole thing down to it, it's unfair to him, and I'm sure listeners are tired of us making this case, but like a lot of this boils down to if Devin Jackson really takes this step. And I think if he does, what's going on with Braden Platt doesn't matter as much. The development maybe of Dylan and Gavin is still important, but it's not quite to the same level it would be. But if he's just kind of the same player and it's moments of brilliance, but a lot of moments where he's, you know, missing the gap and slow to react and doesn't really play with the physicality that's needed to get things done, then I think we're going to really be rueing and kind of bummed out by this Braden Platt injury.
All right. Thank you for watching on YouTube and listening to wherever you get your podcast. For fans of this pod, we've got a special treat. Use the promo code DUCK60, which is in the bottom of your screen, to get the 60% off an annual subscription to deckterritory.com. If you're a podcast listener, that also works for you as well. Go and just type in the promo code DUCK60 when you sign up for a new subscription at duckterritory.com, where you can get the latest recruiting ranking, recruiting news, transfer portal updates, and, of course, importantly, wall-to-wall coverage of Oregon athletics that Eric, myself, Jackson Moore provide here on duckterritory.com. Until the next one, you've been listening to the Odds and Audibles podcast.
Talk to you later, folks.
Out of the shadows of Paramount Mountain, three heroes level up. Axe, Tyrus, and Gilius battle against the evil giant Death Adder to save the kingdom of Uria from so much peril. Laser knives, ornery dwarves, bad brothers, sentient skeletons, sword scorpions, death armor, fire, and this thing, that thing, whatever that is, so much peril and heroes.
This is just the beginning of the story of Hampton's
Golden Axe. New series streaming September 16th on Paramount+.